good. Welcome back to the deep dive. You guys have sent in some really like thought-provoking stuff. This one, though, it's Dr. Michael Harbin's study, and it's called Social Justice for Social Outliers in Ancient Israel. But this is part four, Karspa City, specifically focused on widows, orphans, and resident aliens provisions. I think he calls it WARA for short. So we're going to kind of dive into that and look at how, you know, ancient Israelite society, you know, made provisions for these folks, you know, these vulnerable groups.
Yeah. So this deep dive, we'll really be looking at four main programs that Dr. Harbin outlines that were designed to support those who he calls WARA, widows, orphans, and resident aliens, which, you know, essentially means those residing in the land who weren't native Israelites. Yeah. And those four programs are levirate marriage, gleaning tithes, and third year tithes, and Sabbath year garnering. And what's so interesting is that these practices, these ancient practices, actually reveal a deep concern for people on the margins.
Yeah, for sure. And to really kind of grasp how significant these programs were, you really have to understand the societal backdrop that Dr. Harbin kind of paints, right? We're talking about an agricultural community. So the extended family, I mean, these are like much larger kinship groups than we see today, right? Like multiple generations, close relatives, all living together, sharing resources, really form like the core of social life. And so for those without land or family support, you know, especially these orphans, folks, you know, access to agricultural resources was a fundamental challenge. So these provisions were absolutely critical as safety nets. So, okay, let's start unpacking all this, maybe starting with levirate marriage.
Sure. So levirate marriage, as Dr. Harbin details, was a very, very specific provision. It applied only to widows who were still of childbearing age and who, and this is key, did not have children. And what's striking here is that it's not just the provision itself, but the societal commitment, right? This idea that no woman should be left completely without support or family, even after her husband died. It's not just practicalities here, but it's about maintaining social cohesion and preventing destitution in a patriarchal society. The primary aim here was for a male relative, usually the brother of the deceased husband, to marry the widow and produce an heir. And this son would carry on, you know, the deceased husband's lineage and would also be responsible for the widow's care in her later years.
Which makes total sense when you think about, you know, in that culture, children were like the primary means of support,
right, for
the elderly. And as Dr. Harbin points out, if a widow already had children, levirate marriage, it wasn't really necessary. The expectation was that her own children, you know, particularly the oldest son, would inherit the land, would then take care of her.
Yeah, that's right. And the study actually gives some great examples of widows with children from the Old Testament. You have Hiram of Tyre, the skilled bronze worker. He was the son of a widow and seems to have supported his mother. You also have the woman from Tekoa who goes to David. And she's concerned about losing her sons, because if that happens, she won't have anyone to support her after her husband's death. And of course, there's the widow in Zarephath during the famine, who is like down to her last meal with her son before Elijah shows up. These examples really highlight the expectation that children, especially sons, would care for their mothers after their father's death.
Yeah. And it's interesting to kind of contrast this Old Testament emphasis on family land with the perspective that Paul gives in 1 Timothy 5. He's writing from a more urban context, you know, in Ephesus. And Paul, he emphasizes the responsibility of children or grandchildren to care for widows. And only if there's no family support does the church then step in. It's a different setting, but the principle of family responsibility stays the same. What I find fascinating is how levirate marriage actually worked. The son born from this union wouldn't take the name of his biological father, you know, the deceased husband's brother, but the name and heritage of the deceased first husband. So that way the family line continues and the widow's place within that family line is secured. It shows just how important lineage and the social standing of women were back then. Okay, let's move on to the second provision, gleaning. Dr. Harbin calls this like the primary support system for all three widowed groups. So widows, any age, as long as they hadn't remarried fatherless children, who were probably living with their widowed mothers, and then the unemployed resident aliens.
Right. Gleaning basically meant going through fields and orchards after the harvest was done and collecting anything the harvesters missed. It would be less than the main harvest, obviously, but it could still be quite a lot of food. And there's like a real sense of dignity in gleaning, you know. It provides a way to get food that requires effort, so you're not totally dependent on handouts. Makes you think about like modern debates about welfare and work, right? Even in ancient times, they understood that having some agency in receiving aid was important.
It's interesting that the concept isn't completely like foreign today. My parents actually told me about how their Sunday school class used to glean cornfields back in southern Indiana. Not that long ago, really.
Absolutely. And while the story of Ruth gleaning in Boaz's field is the most famous, the Old Testament actually gives guidelines for gleaning not just grain, but also vineyards, that's in Leviticus 19, and olive trees, which is in Deuteronomy 24. So there would have been chances to glean throughout the whole harvest season if the landowners were following the rules, that is.
Yeah. The key principle seems to be that farmers were expected to, like, plan for a surplus so there'd be enough for gleaning. Dr. Harbin mentions Oda Borowski, who argues that there were actually agricultural surpluses in Iron Age Israel because of new technology. It challenges the idea that they were just scraping by, you know, at a subsistence level. And he ties this to the idea in the Bible that God provides abundance when people trust in him. He uses Boaz as an example because Boaz was doing well even during a famine.
And if we think bigger picture here, this ancient idea of gleaning is really like a modern concept of having a margin, right? Whether it's finances or resources or whatever, you know, living below your means so you have something to share, to help those in need. It makes you think about how intentional we are about that in our own lives.
For sure. And Dr. Harbin actually gets into the specifics about, like, the rules landowners were given to make sure there was enough for gleaning. Things like, don't reap all the way to the edge of your field. The Mishnah, that's a collection of Jewish traditions and interpretations from later on, suggests that at least 1/60th of the harvest should be left. And you had to leave fallen sheaves behind, and you couldn't go back to collect stuff you missed. These rules also applied to olive trees and vineyards. You know, leaving some olives and grapes for the gleaners.
What's interesting is that this could have provided food year-round. The study mentions that harvest started with grain in the spring and ended with olives in the fall. So theoretically, gleaners could have gathered enough to preserve food for the winter, though they probably faced the same preservation challenges as everyone else.
Right. And the key thing is that gleaning gave the WRA access to food from land they didn't own. But it wasn't just a freebie. They had to go out and collect it, thresh it, process it. It took work.
Which brings up a really interesting point about the underlying principles here. First, this idea of a planned margin, right? And the research highlights that it has modern parallels, like managing your money well, tithing, and having enough to help others, even if it means making tough choices or finding ways to earn more. And second, that those who needed help had to actively participate. They had to put in the work to benefit.
All right, let's move on to the third provision, tithes, and the third year tithe. We all kind of know tithing is giving 10%, and Dr. Harbin makes it clear that in general, Israelites were required to tithe 1/10 of all their agricultural products.
So in Leviticus 27, the tithe is first described as belonging to the Lord. But then Numbers 18 explains that the Levites are the ones who receive it, like as part of their inheritance, representing the Lord, so to speak. Mm. And there were 48 Levitical cities spread throughout the land, which suggests they were used as storehouses for these tithes.
It's interesting. Leviticus 18 also says that the Levites had to give 1/10 of what they received back to the Lord as an offering. The research suggests that this portion was probably eaten, like in God's presence, maybe during some kind of central feast. But they also had the option to sell it and buy replacements at the sanctuary.
Logistically, with a national tithe coming in from everywhere, J.A. Thompson's suggestion makes sense, and Dr. Harbin refers to this. He says that maybe a small portion was taken for a central feast, but most of it was stored in those Levitical cities for the Levite support.
Then there's the third year tithe, which is described in Deuteronomy 14. Unlike the regular tithe, this one wasn't sent to the Levitical cities. It was kept locally in the towns.
And the purpose of this third year tithe was to help the widower, the widows, orphans, and resident aliens, and also the Levites, but only as needed. It basically acted like a local food pantry for emergencies within the community. So we've got gleaning, which was a more hands-on form of support where people had to work. How did the third-year tithe, which you said didn't have a work requirement, fit into this whole system of support?
Good question. Dr. Harbin points out that the produce for this third-year tithe was already processed when it was given out. It says, it was reckoned as grain from the threshing floor or the full produce from the vine vat. So it was ready to be stored and used right away, which implies that it was meant for people in more immediate need who maybe couldn't go out and glean or process food themselves.
What's interesting is that, yeah, unlike with gleaning, there doesn't seem to have been a requirement to work in order to receive from the third year tithe. So it was probably for those temporary, urgent situations where folks couldn't work.
Which makes it different from gleaning, which, like we talked about, could maybe provide for someone over a longer period of time, like having a stockpile at home, sort of.
The basic principle of tithing here is pretty clear. God wanted a tenth to be given back, and this was to support the Levites, who were teachers and spiritual guides, and also the needy in the community. The study mentions that the New Testament doesn't give specific instructions about tithing for the church, which could mean that the Old Testament was considered enough, or that giving was meant to be led by God on an individual basis. But either way, this idea of supporting God's work and those in need with a portion of what you earn, that seems to continue.
Okay, last but not least, let's talk about Sabbath year garnering. Dr. Harbin says this one's the most complicated of the provisions. It's the seventh year, when the land had to rest. Israelites weren't allowed to plant, tend, or harvest anything, according to Leviticus 25. The research talks about how there's debate, and it's hard to completely understand how it worked in practice.
Yeah, and Dr. Harbin highlights three main issues that are debated about the Sabbath year. First, there's just the straight-up cycle of 6 years of work, 1 year of total rest for the land. Second, the main purpose. Was it mainly for the land to rest or to provide for the poor? The study argues that the text emphasizes land rest, but it does acknowledge that it helped the poor. And third, could the Israelites actually eat the food that grew on its own during the Sabbath year? It seems contradictory, even within Leviticus 25 itself. Dr. Harbin really gets into the wording of Leviticus 25, where the difference between harvesting and eating what the land produces is key to understanding what seems like a contradiction.
Because it'd be tough to go a whole year with no crops, some people have come up with other interpretations, like maybe individual farmers left a portion of their land fallow each year, or they rotated which land was left fallow.
But the study also presents some strong arguments for a universal seventh-year Sabbath, where everyone observed it at the same time. It points to the fact that in Exodus, the six-day, seventh-day Sabbath is mentioned right alongside the six-year, seventh-year Sabbath, like they're meant to be parallels. It also mentions 2 Chronicles 36, which says that part of the reason for the exile was that they didn't observe the Sabbath year. And the text itself tells people not to worry about the seventh year because God will provide a superabundant harvest in the sixth year.
And Dr. Harbin, based on Kuchi's perspective, concludes that the Sabbath year was probably meant to be universal, happening for everyone at the same time every seventh year.
And about the volunteer produce, it seems like the main purpose was indeed for the land to rest, which also gave the farmers and their animals a break. Exodus 23 says that the poor could gather and eat whatever grew on its own, but Leviticus 25.6 expands on that. Status is that the farmer and their household, including servants and resident aliens, could also eat what the land produced naturally.
The research resolves the apparent contradiction by explaining that the main point was to stop regular farming activities, no harvesting as usual. The Sabbath year basically put everyone on an equal footing. Landowners and warrior alike depended on God to provide.
It was a symbolic year, reminding people that God is the ultimate creator and provider and that he owns the land. Importantly, people were allowed to walk through the fields and gather whatever crops grew naturally without any cultivation.
Zooming out to the bigger picture, Dr. Harbin then talks about the overall social structure that made these provisions for the WR possible. He revisits some ideas from part one of his study and highlights three key things.
First, these integrated extended families, based on the 13 tribes of Jacob. The research points out that even some ethnic outliers like Caleb and native tribes like the Gibeonites were absorbed into these families. What's important is that this social justice and assimilation usually happened at the level of clans and extended families within villages. It's amazing how these structures point to a really interconnected society. How did this focus on extended family and sharing resources actually work in everyday life for the ancient Israelites?
Well, it really created this strong sense of responsibility within the community. Because these tight-knit extended families were the foundation of society, people naturally expected their relatives to help out when they needed it. And as outsiders became part of these families, that circle of responsibility just grew larger over time.
Second, there's the way land was divided up within these community fields. Smaller plots, all mixed together, no walls, and the rule about not harvesting to the edges. All this encouraged cooperation between farmers and made gleaning much easier.
And third, the third year tithe, which was managed locally by the Levites. This shows that the community, and maybe even the religious system, played a part in social justice. Although the research reminds us that the Levites were the only nationwide system in Israel back then.
And the study connects all these structural elements to the fundamental principle of you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which is reflected in those last six of the Ten Commandments, the ones that deal with relationships between people.
It highlights the fact that while their social fabric was built for mutual support, the Torah also included these specific safety nets for the WRA. It recognized that in a fallen world, people are vulnerable.
To wrap up some key points about these social justice provisions, the study points out that there's a balance. Some provisions, like gleaning and Sabbath year garnering, required the recipient to put in effort. Others, like the third-year tithe, were for those in more immediate need and didn't have a work requirement. There were provisions for both short-term emergencies and longer-term needs. And importantly, the whole system depended on the community being willing to live below their means and create a margin of surplus so they could share. And finally, social justice was mainly handled at the local level, in the villages, with neighbors helping those they knew personally.
Yeah. So even though these specific provisions were designed for a very different society, a homogeneous agricultural society, Dr. Harbin concludes that the underlying principles are still relevant. This idea of a planned margin, personal responsibility, community support, addressing vulnerability. He says they can provide insights and a foundation for developing social justice solutions today, even though our context is vastly different.
It really does make you think about how our own safety nets are structured and the values they're based on.
This has been a really valuable deep dive, looking at how a historical society tried to care for its most vulnerable members.
It has. And it leaves us with a final thought. Thinking about those ancient principles, which one, you know, the strong emphasis on family and community support, the mandatory margin for the vulnerable, or the idea that aid should be paired with dignified work, which of those would be the most relevant today? Or the most challenging to put into practice? It's something to think about.